You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is the fastest growing social media application for outdoor enthusiasts, and it's designed by outdoor enthusiasts. If you want more information, visit Google Play Store and download the app, or visit timetogowild.com. Let's get outside. It's time to go wild.
Welcome to the For Love of the Land Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dine.
All right, well,
each week we're interviewing guests from across America. They all have one thing in common.
Weird.
They all are tied to the land. So if you're like us and you love all things land,
welcome home.
A couple of weeks.
So we had the holidays and then was on a big long trip and it's like, wow, it's just, it was that definitely that feeling of, man,
oh,
it's good to be home.
And the baby.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
And can't forget about her.
That was kind of beginning of December, and then that led into the holidays, and so this is like the first podcast in a while where it feels like we're kind of got our feet under us and we're not running crazy trying to record a podcast.
Crazy,
not too crazy, yeah. Because
that's
debatable,
but I mean, yeah, it just depends on your perspective.
Not
on
as
it.
Crazy.
Yeah, there, yeah, we go. That's probably crazy. More accurate.
So this is obviously For Love of the Land podcast, and this week, another holiday week, we had celebrated New Year's, so happy New Year's to you guys. 2019, hopefully, is best year yet. We feel like it's going to be our best year yet. A lot of big things coming for us. Make sure you go and subscribe to the YouTube channel.
Yep.
And be sure to be keeping eyes on that as we progress in 2019 with some big things coming for you guys there. So
That'll certainly be good. There'll be some additions to like the apparel line as well coming in later spring, stuff like that. But truthfully, 2019 is going to be a great year, I think. A lot of growth, a lot of new things for us, and a lot of new opportunities. And and honestly, we got everyone who listens on a weekly basis to thank for that. So certainly thank you guys very much for sticking with us, hanging out, and listening to us to talk. All this time that we talk.
That's right. All this time that we ramble on about habitat. And now we get to ramble on about all. It's an open canvas for what we get to cover on the For Love of the Land podcast.
Yes.
And
yes, it is.
And this week we're going to kind of discuss, since it's another week without interviews with agents because of the holiday season, we are going into it with a kind of just to discuss the land use, historically speaking, today, comparison, and where we're at in kind of 2019 with what basically what we see in a landscape versus what we would have seen had we have been riding on a horseback in a Lewis and Clark expedition, basically Lewis and Clark expedition across the Great West, or Henry Schoolcraft in the Midwest.
Well, and this goes back to truth for the title of the podcast, For Love of the Land. And I think for everyone who does listen and loves the land, and if you haven't already, I guess I should preface, really truthfully study your area, because hopefully within the podcast today, we're going to talk about maybe your area or somewhere you've visited or have interest in. And we're going to share some awesome history of those places. But I think it's important to know and further love where you're at and the land and what it should be, it could be. Do that history on the landscape, land use, maybe the creatures that inhabited it. And you won't walk outside the next day and every day after that looking at it in the same way. I think it will certainly change your perspective and allow you to grow in your understanding of land historically and in the future and the way things should be. And if you see an issue, maybe perhaps a better way to address it by knowing its past. I think sometimes, you know, to move forward, we have to know the past. And this podcast specifically is going to highlight some of that across the country in specific regions. And so I know we've touched on a lot of these aspects probably before, not necessarily in this format within our Habitat podcast, but this is going to allow us to really kind of break down some regions, break down some key features in those regions, maybe some key species, whether it's animals or plants, And as to why they were there and what happened to, whether it's their demise, you know, whether it's a Chestnut and the or American Buffalo or Pine Savannas, whatever it is, kind of talk about that and get an understanding of what things used to be like.
Yeah. And really, I'm going to encourage you, if you listen to this podcast, you find it interesting, you don't want to miss one of the Habitat podcasts coming up with Dr. Duane Estes of the Southeastern Grasslands Initiative, because he is so knowledgeable on this sort of thing in the Southeast. Check out their Facebook page as well, because they're doing a lot of great things, kind of unearthing the history of the Southeast and how basically the landscape has changed so much. Mm-hmm. And there's just really a lot of misinformation out there about what our country looked like before it was settled.
And a lot of
he unearths a lot of things that make you go, oh, yeah, like looking back to maps that are in France and Spain of whenever the first people sailed over and what they were basically journaling of what the landscape looked like, and then compare that to what maybe the history books tell us from when we were in school, and then really kind of what actually occurred. And he always talks about the myth of the squirrel, and we won't share it now because that's kind of his thing, and I can't wait because we're going to have him explain that in the future. But that's just the Southeast. This is
occurring
in the Northeast and the North Great Lakes and the Great Plains and Southwest. And I mean, the Southwest, the desert states. Everybody talks about the desert states and how basically you may love the Southwest and the deserts, but did you know that the deserts weren't always just deserts? Yep. They were really grasslands that were overgrazed and mismanaged that led into the desertification. I'm really struggling with this tonight.
Words can be tough.
They can be tough, especially when they get past four letters in a word.
Yeah.
But basically, those were converted with poor management to deserts and the degrading of the soil. And that's occurring in other parts of our country, but we're not as far forward in the mismanagement to where it's not considered desert, but if we continue the same practices and management styles, our grandkids may look at it and say, well, the great desert of western Oklahoma or the great desert of Nebraska because of mismanagement. So be aware of the land use and some of the horrible things that are happening are having a negative impact.
Well, it doesn't take long at all in a simple Google search for someone to look at water issues in, let's say, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, California. There's a big reason as to why they're having these issues in those regions. There's documentaries on it, Netflix. I encourage you to look them up, check them out, learn why they're having those. And the solution is better management and in those areas to bring back grasslands that will infiltrate the water. The little bit of water that they do get and receive on an annual basis is gone in an instant in that landscape.
Because of runoff. Yep.
Correct, because of runoff, lack of infiltration to the water table, because of vegetation.
Or species that are there that don't allow water to infiltrate.
Correct.
And habitat people know, we talk about eastern red cedar, but it's actually a juniper, and out west, it's tons of juniper trees. Rocky Mountain.
Yeah, a different type of juniper, but still in the family. But they lost their grasslands and then are replaced right by these junipers. And
a species that creates a sponge-like effect versus a species that creates more of a brick-type effect for water.
The general landscape. So infiltration versus just runoff.
Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation just shared a article not too long ago that was talking about a study they did where they found that the juniper trees could use up to 30 gallons of water a day.
Yeah.
And so
they were spending conservation dollars to go in and physically remove these trees by mulching in certain areas to bring back
grasslands. And forbs,
right, in these areas. So it's
because
not...
Because the junipers aren't providing forage for the wildlife either.
Right.
Right. Most of the wildlife.
Right. Most of them. So, but no doubt, though, that's a perfect example of over time, that area, that environment, that ecosystem has changed drastically and is now not as productive in its landscape and what it could be and should be.
Well, a big part of California, the western side, used to be savannas, oak savannas, and other types of savannas. So that means that a savanna is a landscape that was controlled by two main things, fire and grazing. Mm-hmm. And in California specifically, grazing has been removed somewhat. There's still grazing that's happening, but not like it was naturally occurring. And then there was also fire. Well, we know the fire was removed on a regular basis, lightning strike fires during a time of the year when it was a little bit more controlled. But now the fire that happens there is whenever you have the lack of fire for years and years, mm-hmm. and fuel loads build up and build up and build up to a point where they can't hold anymore. It's like having a water hose going into a bucket. It fills it up, but at some point it comes boiling over, and that's really, you have a landscape that's should be burned. It's naturally burned, but when we don't burn it, we just have fuel loads build up and build up to a point where then when you do have the fire weather, one little spark can light the whole countryside on fire.
Yeah, and it's those are what you're seeing, the fires these days are catastrophic and detrimental because of the lack of mismanagement and the changes in land use. And I think that, again, when we look at land use, you know, today, we should be pairing what the climate and the historical presence was in that area from a vegetation standpoint. We should be, whether it's our agriculture or whatever, we should be replicating and growing things in the climate that is conducive to that climate. Part of the water issue in places like California and Arizona, there's farms out there who are growing because of the length of growing season, basically year-round wise, growing vegetables, huge produce areas. But we're missing the point of those areas don't receive rain. So it's like we're trying to grow vegetables that require X amount of rainfall and water intake per growing season, and they don't get it naturally, so we got to do different things to bring in water and irrigate considerable amounts. And it's like, well, why can't we grow that elsewhere where it makes more sense to the environment? It's an evolving thing, and it's a complex thing. I'm not saying this, you know, this is the exact issue, and this is the solution to it all. However, if we mimic nature in the way that we produce our food, the way that we use the land, we won't see such dramatic effects, and whether it's catastrophic ways that really the earth is fighting back at things in the way we do it. So I just think that, like we said and kind of prefaced, if we learn from the past, we can make great educated decisions on how to use the land in the future.
I can't remember if it was Food Inc., but it was the documentary that you're not calling it out, but you're discussing it, where in one of the valleys not too far from San Diego is where a majority of the water use for the entire state is used, and they're growing alfalfa and yeah. all these like vegetables,
broccoli, cabbage, and all
in
this
an
stuff.
Area that was natural, like desert or basically a very dry atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And what they did was started pumping in from a lake and irrigating all this, but now they're realizing that they're using more water to irrigate those fields than they have to use for their yeah. personal use. And so now they're starting to tax them on the water use to where the people can't afford to water. Yep. And there's this huge fight of, well, we're using the water, we shouldn't be taxed. But it's like, well, where's the...
And I want to say that there was also issues with asthma in that area.
Yes, there is.
Because of the constant turnover of soil, and it gets airborne.
Yep.
And it's limiting the amount of exposure that kids can be outside. And it's funny because this this stuff isn't typically talked about, or I certainly, maybe I'm sheltered from it. I don't have regular TV, but I don't see much news exposure.
Excuse me. About
this stuff.
Asthma.
Yeah, but it's like the way we're utilizing the land is linked directly to this, and
to
we're
the
harming
health of us. Yes,
yeah. We're harming ourselves. So
there was
why
another,
are we doing it?
Another book that I'm gonna buy at some point, and I'll put it on a stack of books of things I've got to read. But it was talking about there is like 70% less nutrients in broccoli today than 1920.
This is powerful,
mind blowing,
and
then now
crazy.
They're linking the health of soil to the health of the internal digestive tract of the humans that inhabit that area. So, like, the healthier soil you have, meaning the more trace minerals and micronutrients in that soil, means that there's healthier bacteria and basically healthier digestive tracts of the humans that live and eat off that land.
To me, you know, the push of eating local and stuff is super important for, you know, economic reasons. But you're only as good, and I think we've done this comparison with whitetail deer and habitat and everything in the past, but as humans, though, we're only as good as we allow ourselves to be based on the food that we eat, the nutrients that we feed ourselves.
Yeah.
And there's, again, direct correlations between all this.
Oh, for sure. It comes down to the amount of nutrients you're getting out of your food. And a person, obviously, we all know this. This isn't rocket science. There's been so much research. But if you eat nothing but junk food, you live a very unhealthy lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you eat what you believe healthy, you may go to the store and eat all the vegetables in the world that are on the rack or whatever it is. Even if you're eating those, you're still not getting the true, most part, the mass-produced vegetables aren't as nutrient-rich as the stuff you can grow in your garden that you're managing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of like a thing that more and more people are starting these organic gardens and doing these these little farm shows, these little farm
Farmers markets
mm-hmm. is growing rapidly because of this.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to the misuse of our land and getting further and further away from the natural cycle of what occurred on our land.
Yeah.
And so, like, for this podcast, we're going to cover several areas of really what the landscape looked like pre-settlement and what it looks like now.
Let's jump in to kind of the southeast, because, again, that's one we've talked about, we've mentioned in the past, is a hot topic. There's a lot of information out there on it.
And I know we're going to cover it a lot with Dr. Dwayne Essex, so we won't go through it in great detail, but let's just go to it and say, okay, what does it look like now? Now, I said his myth of the squirrel, and people talk about the Southeast being heavily forested,
right?
With pine plantations that are planted by man, but also just naturally occurring forest, where we get in this cycle of thinking that the Southeast is dominated by forest and should always be dominated by forest.
Well, it's not. It doesn't take anybody long. If you've ever visited the Southeast and driven from, let's say, Atlanta, Georgia, down to Vicksburg, Mississippi, across to Louisiana, you are in pine country. You see pines along the highway from basically start to finish. And thick pines, thick growing pines. Like I said, pine plantations. You'll get these hardwood bottoms. However, what you see is not what should or has been there in the past. That area throughout much of the country was open.
Yeah, lot of
vastly.
Lot of grasslands, but then going into a lot of woodlands and a lot of savannas, which I'm not even sure who to credit for this. I think it was Dr. Dwayne Essex that I heard describe it, and this is my favorite description of a savanna, but one guy could look at it and say it's a forest. The other guy could look at it and say it's a grassland. It's got scattered trees, but lots of grass and forbs. A woodland's got more trees on it, but it's still got a lot of undergrowth of grasses and forbs growing. That was a lot of landscape. Very fragmented.
Extremely fragmented.
Not these vast, vast grasslands that you think of like Kansas, Oklahoma, North and South Dakota, but more smaller in scale, but still lots of lots and lots of acres devoted to being open grasslands or savannas.
Millions.
One
of
the biggest ones, southeast Arkansas, actually where we just visited. The Grand Prairie, of southeast Arkansas, down around Stuttgart, and in the middle of now crop country.
I honestly try to envision as we're driving through that area, and then looking at the greater, like the macro view of East Arkansas, and not all East Arkansas was like this.
No, northeast Arkansas was swampy, lots of cypress, and it's still kind of like that, busted up into
fragmented into cropland. But I look at it and I just think, how productive and incredible would that have been to see in its heyday, pre-settlement, of these still some swamps, some flooded land, flooded timber and stuff in this area, but that mixture of prairie and then these river systems, that would have been absolutely incredibly gorgeous.
Tons of ducks. And beavers.
Tons of beavers, tons of deer, tons of turkey, tons of bison, tons of elk, everything.
I want to say something. When you compare to some of the government cost share programs, what is something that's growing that we're seeing in crop country? Buffer strips. Mm-hmm. People are adding these buffer strips of diverse natives, grasses and forbs, around their crop fields to help control erosion, to help filter water as it's coming off the field. Think about how the terrain is with the Mississippi River. Let's just use that for example. When you look at the edge of the Mississippi River, you're going to see a lot of river breaks, but also crop flat ground. Like, let's just say southeast Mississippi. All the water that goes out of, there's two main filter ecosystems, swamps and grasslands. Think about how those laid with the river. Mm-hmm. All the amount of water that would run off wouldn't run off on the native landscape.
In those right situations.
But in areas where you could get a lot of water, you had these habitat types, these landscapes that were amazing to at soaking up water.
I would love to see the transition between, and we saw this a little bit in Nebraska, we're in the sand hills, but you go from basically plains. Those were more of a short grass prairie.
Yep.
But you go from a prairie setting, tall grass in the Grand Prairie we were talking about in Arkansas, into wetland grass, wetland grassland areas, into more riparian, and then into the swamp. Like we have, or most people now think of, okay, upland hardwoods, maybe pines, and then bottom ground.
Yeah.
Hardwoods. And like, that's your definition of land use throughout the southeast these days. But back then, it was like grasslands. But I guess I'm comparing timber to grasslands. You still had these different varied stages and extremely diverse grasses in each area, and they all served a purpose. And they are all extremely functional in filtering water and having incredible forages.
Yep, absolutely. Think about it. Let's list out some of the, while we're speaking of water infiltration, list out some of the habitat types or the landscape uses that aren't great for water infiltration. High tillage crop ground.
Yep.
Not great. Overgrazed pasture ground. Terrible. Monocultures of grasslands.
Yep.
Of pasture. Are not great.
Yep.
Closed canopy forest is not great.
Yep.
Monoculture timber practices, pine plantations come to mind.
Not great.
So there's five.
And named off all the land uses currently in those areas.
And then if you go to a map that's like land use in America in 2018, one of the biggest ones is cow pastures and rangeland. Now that's very broad because that covers
Tons of different types of grasses.
But we know that as a whole, there would be more mismanagement with the grazing than probably high-use rotational grazing, which is more better
for...
That's
way outweighted.
Yes. So, that's probably our biggest land use in the country is cow pasture as a whole. And not just cows, but sheep and goats and horses as well. And so that's not great for water infiltration. Then the next one, livestock feed. So we're growing crops to feed monoculture crops.
Monoculture crop production.
That's not great either.
Although I did see this. I saw an article yesterday. Interviewed a very innovative cover cropper. We talked about on the podcast, Gabe Brown, in the past. He has three predictions. And I can't remember. I probably will be able to remember two of them. But he had three predictions about the way farming is going to go in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
One of them was a very unique way of producing crops. And it was using two different crops at the same time, growing two different crops, intercropping. And so a field would have two different crops growing at the same time, harvest differently, but utilizing that same ground for multi-crop production. And so he's saying that's one direction, and it's going to be incorporated more into the next couple years. So that's a great way to get away from the monoculture production and change our current feed and food production.
So another what was one, an example of that?
So I've seen in the past wheat and soybeans growing in the same field. So wheat's going to come in and we're talking the same time. So spaced differently.
Yeah.
So your inner rows are soybeans planted in the spring, and then the wheat was planted last winter.
Yeah.
So they come in and harvest the wheat before the soybean gets up too high.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So intercropping.
Yep.
So utilizing more fields for that type of farming. One, because, and I think that's maybe the purpose, farming's incredibly expensive these days. People, I think you may have seen the same thing, but farmer suicides is going way up.
Way up. And especially in dairy farmers up. Because
yeah.
They're
not making money anymore.
No.
And it's so hard, especially in wet years like this, to make and get crops out to even pay for all the debt you're in. So you've got to be more productive in each acre that you have.
Yep.
And that's another way to do it, as well as increase the quality of the land use that you have.
Yep.
Another thing he was talking about was food scanners, which looks at the nutrition levels in produce. So kind of like you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
With, there's differences in, the land use and the health of your soil, and how much nutrients is in your vegetables. Looking at that, but having them available to the everyday public. So they go into grocery stores and basically
just,
can scan.
Just tell everybody that we're both fighting colds. So if you hear awkward pauses,
it's a cough to the left or to the right.
Yeah.
Ooh, it's been really since mid-December, both tribe been fighting and shaking this thing. But that was another technique or something that he saw in the next 10 years was going to come available and be a part of
people
our lifestyle.
People are becoming more and more concerned about where their food is coming from. And so you've got people that are now going into hunting and fishing because they want to know exactly where their meat comes from. Or they're moving to a small hobby farm to raise a few cows because they want to be able to know where their beef comes from. And it's becoming crucial, even in the vegetable world, of do I know that this broccoli or something wasn't gassed, so I know it's going to be fresh longer?
Right, right.
I want to make my own bread because there's something a little concerning about having a loaf of bread on the countertop for 2 months and it never going bad.
Yeah.
When mama makes it, it goes bad in a week.
Well, when mama made it, it was so good, it got ate. Before, but if it ever was one piece or crumb, it'd get moldy. We're getting way off topic, but I think it all comes back to the way we do things in the modern world and the way that we preserve our food, the way that we make our food, and the way that we treat our land, because that's a direct correlation to our food. We're going in a direction where we don't have an option but to change it.
Yep.
Because we're experiencing so many detrimental effects in our landscape, in our ecosystem, that we have to change. We have to evolve. We have to do things differently because what we've done in the past is not working. Or there's not a bright future in that management, that technique, those methods. We've got to change. We've got to evolve. And I think the people, consumers, are going to call for that perhaps before everyone jumps on board.
Well,
producers.
Who are the people that are becoming more and more successful in the farming world are the guys that have broke
innovators.
Out. And the Gabe Browns of the world who have mm-hmm. done things different to where when you buy vegetables from him, you know you're getting some vegetables from mm-hmm. some great soil. There's lots of nutrients.
Yep.
You buy beef, you know it hasn't been touched with whatever all the bad stuff
hormones,
is out there that
hormones,
you're worried about. It's these grass-fed, organic guys that are starting to really market this stuff. And it's because more people on the coasts and in the cities are really looking for that because they see the health benefits there.
Yep.
So we talked about Southeast. Lots of grasslands
mm-hmm.
Mixed in with savannas and woodlands going to forests, but a very fragmented landscape. In simple terms, we say this probably with every client, but think about closed canopy forest being one color while a grassland is another color and a woodlands another color and savannas are another color. It wasn't just one color spread out over this huge acres and acres and counties and states. It was a very fragmented where there was lots of colors and lots of different habitat types stretching out across the Southeast. Specifically, one of the biggest changes you'll see is the longleaf pine
mm-hmm.
Population, longleaf pine savannas. So you have a mix of these huge pine trees. And if you haven't seen a longleaf pine in person, travel down south and look at one. They're absolutely beautiful. But they had naturally occurring fires that really, really kind of just made this very fragmented landscape of lots of pines mixed with grasses and forbs, which provided phenomenal habitat for a lot of species, but specifically the northern bobwhite. But due to the Industrial Revolution, where they call it yellow pine, which really covered four different species of pine, longleaf being one of them, a lot of them got cut out, and then that ground got turned into cotton farms and other corn and other types of agriculture. And so, some of those have tobacco.
Yep.
Some of those have progressed back into pine plantations. But we've really kind of avoided the diversity that was native to that region.
We looked when you say pine plantation, it goes into pine production. So
yeah.
Monoculture of basically too many stems per acre, and you're not getting that understory that was present.
Yeah.
The base, the main tree is back, but the diversity within the habitat and ecosystem and infiltration and the role that it played is not there anymore.
No.
So
the habitat is
strictly
so far gone. So that's one of the big ones down south, southeast. Let's just use longleaf pine as an example. You go to where you're from, let's just go east coast, and you get into the Smoky Mountains or whatever mountains you guys call them.
Appalachian Blue Ridge.
Those hills over there?
Them big old hills.
Yeah.
And then the Smokies down south. They were not nearly as dominated in timber as the Piedmont regions of North Carolina and Virginia were not all forested like what we're seeing these days. A lot of those areas have experienced incredible amounts of timber harvest year after years and years and years and years since settlement, since the 1600s, of basically removing and cutting out high value trees and letting it go. And so we're seeing forest degradation, and what was forest now has been mismanaged by cattle removed and grown up. And now, so what was open has been mismanaged and is now closed off into forested areas. So again, even through the Piedmont regions and the foothills of many of the mountain ranges and partial areas within the mountain ranges, of course, there was tons of meadows, which again is a grassland. But you saw fire in that landscape, which increased the diversity and openness of those regions. So again, what you see on the East Coast is not normal. It's not what it used to
be. Well, and then go back to the American chestnut too.
Yep, just going there. That tree was, if you will, the patriarch of the East Coast. and advance westward till about the Mississippi. But that American chestnut, forage-wise, from a hard mass production, it produced every single year, and is the most attractive and palatable species of hard mass, I think, that we know of in other varieties. And that tree was so present and populated throughout the East Coast, and then there was the blight and came through and wiped them out, as well as harvesting. So we lost an incredible dominant species of hardwood that produced incredible amounts of forage every single year. And I just go back to think, what would have been like pre-blight to hunt back then? Like, if that was so, it probably would have been tough, but can you imagine if you had
everybody? You know what? I'll just say it. There's guys now that hate white oak trees when they produce acorns, because they're like, oh, you can't hunt with those. Those are probably the guys that if they were living when the blight hit, they would have been happy about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I go back and I'm like, I think of all the tonnage produced by those jokers, and that's, again, every single year. And imagine what it fed, though. Oh. Because in those regions, again, we look at Georgia, we look at North Carolina, Western South Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Elk used to roam these areas not that long ago, 200 years ago, 180 years ago, and bison used to roam these areas. And it's incredible to think that that landscape supported such animals, and now we look at the needs of bison and elk, and it's no wonder that there's restocking efforts. Of course, you know, market hunting played a humongous portion into that, but even the restocking of those animals in these areas, we're only going to see very limited effects and success in there, because our landscape has changed so drastically that we have to consider that in those areas. And they do, to their credit, when they do try and reintroduce a species there.
Well, bogus. I'm going to say bogus.
Huh?
I'm going to say bogus of what you're getting ready to say. They try to restore the native landscape.
Well, I was going to say they try to restore it, because they didn't do that in Virginia, but they did, not land use, but Landsat imagery to really look and say, okay, this has to be the target region, because this is as closely related to their natural landscape. It's been the least amount of manipulation and the least populated areas. This is where they're going to be the most successful. We have to start them here. If we start them anywhere else, it's going to be a failure.
Yeah.
But truthfully, the success of those animals, like, well, we'll use Arkansas, for example. We go through there and we're like, this is either hay fields or close canopy forest. There's no fire in those landscapes anymore. And there's no open canopy, savannas, woodlands, or grasslands left. And it's like, how?
They're a grazing animal, and yet we rely on a non-native pasture to feed them.
Yeah.
When we saw them 2 days ago, they were standing in a pasture.
Yeah. When you look at Buffalo River National River, I believe it is.
Yeah.
Right. All that is.
And this isn't our
protected
areas. Our griping, but I'm gonna do a little bit of upset talk about the Missouri Department of Conservation. Huge supporter of the Missouri Department of Conservation, but with the restoration of the elk in Missouri, we're taking an animal that's native to the area, but we put it in a landscape that's not their native landscape. As in, there's a majority of the area that they're reintroduced that is closed canopy forest. Now, they've done some stuff to try and restore the woodlands and the savannas, but as a whole, a majority of it, when you drive through there, is closed canopy forest. And then the food plots are clovers and orchard grass.
Yes.
And so two non-natives. And so to me, if I want to restore something, I want to put it back into its native landscape. And currently, that's not its native landscape.
Well, what you're looking at is you're making a comparison of, okay, here's a native species we want to reintroduce that lived off of this type of native landscape and yep. vegetation. But now, when we try to make that reintroduction, we don't have the resemblance of the native landscape in those areas.
Nope.
Why not make the native landscape resemble what it was way back when, and then your reintroduction is so much more successful?
Because not only are the elk going to benefit, but so are all the other native species because of the native habitat restoration. They've spent a lot of money to reintroduce the elk. And in my opinion, we should have spent that money in the landscape restoration first and then focus on the elk later.
Well, because...
But they didn't ask for my opinion, so...
They went on without you. But here's the kicker is because, especially within the elk restoration area, which we know specifically here and could speak on, there's a lot of endangered plants from way back when there actually was a working, glades, savannas, woodlands in this area. We've lost that plant diversity, or it's not present anymore on the current landscape and the shape that it's in because it is closed canopy. But right, we could have worked on the habitat first, increased that, brought back these rare and endangered species or threatened species. So our efforts would have been twofold by improving the habitat, bringing back these vegetation species, and then restocking these animals.
Okay, let's go to a new area, southwest Missouri, south central Missouri, the Ozark Highlands or the Ozark Mountains, whatever you want to call them. The native landscape, very fragmented, similar to southeast, but very rocky because of our limestone, basically glades. Lots of rocky terrain, upland woodlands is kind of the native landscape. You'll see a lot of upland woodlands or see that in a lot of our going back and understanding the native landscape, looking into it through software systems like Web Soil Survey. And then you compare that to a lot of the journals. Henry Schoolcraft talked about a lot of the barren hills. Of course, barren used in that time frame was a description of a prairie or a grassy area, a short grass prairie. So a lot of little blue stem made up this landscape. There was also a lot of shrubs that habited here, and also the most popular one is limestone glades. Driving across our country now, what do you see, Matt? People now call them cedar glades. Yeah. This has been an area, of course, hits home for us because of the drastic change, but very fragmented with lots of little meadows that we call glades. But also now they're called cedar glades because of the encroachment of the eastern red cedar. Then you look at our areas of woods, and we have a lot of closed canopy forests and with large oaks in the middle of those forests that are dying out because of the amount of the change in landscape, the amount of competition they have with other trees. We looked at a property yesterday which had large oaks with a bunch of big limbs at the base that were all being... that appeared to be dying off. It's called self-pruning by the tree. It's basically meaning that instead of putting resources up and out, they're putting resources in growing up because they're trying to get to the most sunlight possible. Our landscape here in southwest Missouri has changed drastically due to lack of fire and mismanagement of a grazing animal.
Or removal of
a grazing animal. And so... huge changes that have happened here for us, and it's in a point where you don't really know it until you come to the area and see it, and then you're kind of aware of what to look for. But for example, there's been so much encroachment, and this isn't just in southwest Missouri or south central Missouri with the eastern red cedar. This is happening across the landscape. Ohio, Indiana come to mind with a different species overtaking the understory of trees in the forest. And that basically means that they're going to outcompete in the understory to where the next generation of oaks or whatever the dominant native species is in that region, they're not going to be able to compete. So they die off while this understory tree, whether it's bush honeysuckle, autumn olive, or eastern red cedar, or there's many other Chinese privet down south, where they're completely changing the direction of our of our woods, of our forests. And it's something that a lot of people aren't aware of. But once you train your eye and you become aware of what's happening, you're going to get sick with the amount of habitat destruction that's occurring right in front of us.
Yeah, and it is something to certainly be aware of. And a lot of the consultations I've been on recently was one on Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee, and then Southeast Ohio, and then also in Maryland. Every single one of those, common theme, poor regeneration of native plants.
Yep.
They're because of improper management of the timber, so no TSI, and then no regeneration because they're getting eaten out by the deer and other species. And so there's no regeneration of those valuable species that are going to increase the quality of timber down the road and hard mass production. So
yeah.
American holly, which is not a fire resistant tree, white pine in the Cumberland Plateau was absolutely everywhere. Those weren't being eaten, but there was no management in that.
So they were taking the understory over.
Completely taking it over. Now they're native to that area, but not in that
capacity.
Dominating. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And there was very little oak regeneration.
It's like
in
the
most
Eastern Red Cedar is native to the area, but not in the capacity in the population that's here because of a removal of fire and mismanagement of cows.
Not eradicate that.
Yeah.
It has its role, it has its place, but it needs to be managed because we've forgotten about those steps to manage. Because the property in Tennessee, there was a timber harvest years ago, and they removed a lot of the larger pine off the property, but zero follow-up. The property is thick, and it holds deer, but there's very little oaks in portions of the property.
Yeah.
And now these pines are getting up way too tall. And what was open landscape or open canopy right after the harvest, it filled in. And that filled in with an invaluable species to the wildlife. And I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, but white pine will play a role, but again, not at the capacity. There's hemlocks in those in this timber stand, and they're going to do a lot better of keeping snow off the ground and protecting the deer, giving them a place to bed when it does snow because they've received some snow.
Those are amazing, but to me, very interesting trees because we don't have them here in southern Missouri.
Yeah. But that white pine was playing too much of a role, so it needs to be managed. And again, we can go anywhere, and you guys, this is why I encourage you to step out and listen to these things so that you can make the same judgment call as to what should be here. And at what ratio?
And also, I'll say this. We are not calling for you to be like, man, I hate seeing crop fields. I hate seeing pasture ground.
Right.
We're not saying that stuff is bad. Now, I would like to see a lot less tillage and more CRP buffer strips along the edges to create habitat and help with erosion and water infiltration. I would like to see rotational grazing implemented to where there's not as much hay having to be fed and cows are rotating across the landscape so there's more grass left when they are finished grazing. That's really what we're looking
for. More infiltration.
Yes. And so that's really the goal.
And it's funny because everywhere we go, there seems to be a common theme of changes in water table too. And of course we talked about it in the Southwest earlier, talked about it in the past different podcasts, but you know, here we've got what used to be year-round flowing creeks. They're dry 70% of the year. They're not flowing anymore.
Yeah.
We've seen that change and no one's doing anything about it. And it's because of all these things that we've talked about, mismanagement, not understanding the role that soil layers play and root systems play and diversity on top of the soil.
Underground aquifers.
We have to understand that and realize that in our lifetime, there's things that has changed. And the only way that we're going to make a difference is through change and understanding where we came from.
Education. Yeah. Hopefully we kind of open up the eyes of some people and pique their interest of looking into the native landscape for their area. And I hope one of the big things we're going to challenge Dr. Dwayne Estes when he comes on the podcast soon is how to find this information, other ways to look into this information. I know there's various different ways, and you can look for explorers that came through your area and all kinds of different stuff. But hopefully, hopefully you become aware of what's happening on your landscape. And I mean, I'd be hard pressed to find to say I know somebody who loves improving the land more than me. I think that's where the riff is. You've got hunters, you've got environmentalists, you've got naturalists, you've got all these different groups of people. But I think at the end of the day, we could all say that we have one thing in common, and we do love our landscape. Now, there's going to be differences of opinion on how to manage it.
Or what you should be managing for.
Or what we're managing for. But I think if you come at it from an educational background of saying this was here before I was, and this is the most beneficial way for the land, you could make a pretty good argument with a lot of people that you have the best interest, what's in the best interest for the land. And that's really how we look at it, of going, this is the native landscape, and this is what we're going to try and do to it. And it's basically just bring back what was here before I got here.
No doubt.
So anyway, hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Please share it with your friends. That's one big way you can help support us. You guys have been awesome at supporting us. But in 2019, we're that determined, but we're going to be providing more and more information for you guys in different ways. So be sure to check out all of our pages and subscribe so you don't miss anything.
Absolutely. Next For Love of Land podcast, we'll be having some more land agents on. Sometimes it can be difficult to get on the phone during the holidays. So we're going to have more highlights of properties.
Get them on the phone or get them on the phone during the holidays, because I've noticed it.
On both occasions. So if you have interest on getting the property highlighted here on the podcast, let us know. Send us an email, info@landlegacy.tv, or just any general questions about possibly your area, just knowledge of it and how to manage it. We'd be happy to help you. info@landlegacy.tv. Let us know if you have any questions. We'll see you.